Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
Greetings and welcome to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I am your host, D.B. Spitzer. And between episodes, let's see, 107 and 134, we will be talking about The Beetle. The Beetle, a Mystery, is a 1897 horror novel by British writer Richard Marsh. To tell you about it is to spoil it. So check it out, and that'll be going on from now until sometime in December. This episode is brought to you by FoundOutOnClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with D.B. Spitzer and Seraphie. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, we prefer Podbean and Apple Podcasts. Check out the new website over at pgttcm.com and check out the merch table over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pgttcm, or check us out on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, featuring The Hive, Ghost Story, Ghost Processional, Oppressive Gloom, and our theme song, The Chamber.
Chapter 44, The Man Who Was Murdered. The inspector spoke to me. If what the boy says is correct, it sounds as if the person whom you are seeking may have had a finger in the pie. I was of the same opinion, as apparently were Lessingham and Sidney. Atherton collared the youth by the shoulder, which Mr. Pleasman had left disengaged. What sort of looking bloke is it who's been murdered? I don't know. I haven't seen him. Mrs. Anderson, she says to me, Gustus Barley, she says, a bloke's been murdered. That there Arab what I chucked out half an hour ago been and murdered him and left him behind up in my back room. You run as hard as you can tear and tell them they're dratted pleas what's so fond of shoving their dirty noses into respectable people's houses, so I comes and tells her. That's all I knows about it. We went four in the hansom, which had been waiting in the street, to Mrs. Henderson's in Paradise Place. The inspector and we three, Mr. Pleasman and Gustus Barley, followed on foot. The inspector was explanatory. Mrs. Henderson keeps a sort of lodging house, a sailor's home, she calls it, but no one could call it sweet. It doesn't bear the best of characters, and if you ask me what I thought of it, I should say in plain English that it was a disorderly house. Paradise Place proved to be within 300 or 400 yards of the station house. So far as could be seen in the dark, it consisted of a row of houses of considerable dimensions, and also of considerable antiquity. They opened onto two or three stone steps which led directly into the street. At one of the doors stood an old lady with a shawl drawn over her head. This was Mrs. Henderson. She greeted us with garrulous volubility.
"So you have come, have you? I thought you never was a coming, that I did."
She recognized the inspector.
"It's you, Mr. Phillips, is it?"
Perceiving us, she drew a little back.
Who's them there parties? They ain't coppers?
Mr. Phillips dismissed her inquiry curtly. Never you mind who they are. What's this about someone being murdered?
Shh!
The old lady glanced around.
Don't you speak so loud, Mr. Phillips. No one don't know nothing about it as yet. The party's what's in my house is most respectable, most, and they couldn't abide the notion of there being police about the place.
We quite believe that, Mrs. Henderson. The inspector's tone was grim. Mrs. Henderson led the way up a staircase which would have been distinctly the better for repairs. It was necessary to pick one's way as one went, and as the light was defective, stumbles were not infrequent. Our guide passed outside a door on the topmost landing. From some mysterious recess in her apparel, she produced a key.
It's in here.
I locked the door so that nothing mightn't be disturbed. I knows how particular you pleasemen is. She turned the key, and we all went in, we, this time, in front, and she behind. A candle was guttering on a broken and dilapidated single washhand stand. A small iron bedstead stood by its side, the clothes on which were all tumbled and tossed. There was a rush-seated chair with a hole in the seat, and that, with the exception of one or two chipped pieces of stoneware and a small round mirror, which was hung on a nail against the wall, seemed to be all that the room contained. I could see nothing in the shape of a murdered man, nor, it appeared, could the inspector either.
What's the meaning of this, Mrs. Henderson? I don't see anything here.
It's behind the bed, Mr. Phillips. I left them just where I found them. I wouldn't have touched them, not for nothing. Nor yet have let nobody else have touched him neither. 'Cause as I say, I know how particular you pleasemen is. We all four went hastily forward.
Atherton and I went to the head of the bed, Lessingham and the inspector, leaning right across the bed, peeped over the side. There on the floor in the space which was between the bed and the wall lay the murdered man. At sight of him, an exclamation burst from Sidney's lips.
It's Holt! Thank God, cried Lessingham. It isn't Marjorie.
The relief in his tone was unmistakable. That the one was gone was plainly nothing to him in comparison with the fact that the other was left. Thrusting the bed more into the center of the room, I knelt down beside the man on the floor. A more deplorable spectacle than he presented I have seldom witnessed. He was decently clad in a gray tweed suit, white hat, collar, and necktie, and it was perhaps the fact which made his extreme attenuation the more conspicuous. I doubt if there was an ounce of flesh on the whole of his body. His cheeks and the sockets of his eyes were hollow. The skin was drawn tightly over his cheekbones. The bones themselves were staring through. Even his nose was wasted, so that nothing but a ridge of cartilage remained. I put my arm beneath his shoulder and raised him from the floor. No resistance was offered by the body's gravity. He was as light as a little child. I doubt, I said, if this man has been murdered. It looks to me like a case of starvation or exhaustion. Possibly a combination of both. What's that on his neck? Asked the inspector. He was kneeling at my side. He referred to two abrasions of the skin, one on either side of the man's neck. They look to me like scratches. They seem pretty deep, but I don't think they're sufficient in themselves to cause death. They might be, joined to an already weakened constitution. Is there anything in his pockets? Let's lift him onto the bed. We lifted him onto the bed, a featherweight he was to lift. While the inspector was examining his pockets, to find them empty, a tall man with a big black beard came bustling in. He proved to be Dr. Glossop, the local police surgeon who had been sent for before our quitting the station house. His first pronouncement, made as soon as he commenced his examination, was, under the circumstances, sufficiently startling. I don't believe the man's dead. Why didn't you send for me directly you found him? The question was put to Mrs. Henderson. Well, Dr. Glossop, I wouldn't touch him myself, and I wouldn't have him touched by no one else, because as I've said afore, I know how particular them pleasemen is. Then in that case, if he does die, he'll have had a hand in murdering him, that's all. The lady sniggered. Of course, Dr. Glossop, we all knows that you always have your joke. You'll find it a joke if you have to hang, as you ought to, you... The doctor said what he did say to himself, under his breath. I doubt if it was flattering to Mrs. Henderson. Have you got any brandy in the house?
We've got everything in the house for them as likes to pay for it. Everything.
Then, suddenly remembering that the police were present and that hers were not exactly licensed premises, leastways we can send out for it for them parties as gives us the money, being, as is well known, always willing to oblige. Then send for some. To the tap downstairs, if that's the nearest. If this man dies before you've brought it, I'll have you locked up as sure as you're a living woman. The arrival of the brandy was not long delayed, but the man on the bed had regained consciousness before it came. Opening his eyes, he looked up at the doctor bending over him. Hello, my man. That's more like the time of day. How are you feeling? The patient stared hazily up at the doctor as if his senses of perception was not yet completely restored, as if this big bearded man was something altogether strange. Atherton bent down beside the doctor. I'm glad to see you looking better, Mr. Holt. You know me, don't you? I've been running about after you all day long. You are... The man's eyes closed as if the effort at recollection exhausted him. He kept them closed as he continued to speak. I know who you are. You are the gentleman. Yes, that's it. I'm the gentleman. Name of Atherton. Miss Linden's friend. And I dare say you're feeling pretty well done up. And in want of something to eat and drink. Here's some brandy for you. The doctor had some in a tumbler. He raised the patient's head, allowing it to trickle down his throat. The man swallowed it mechanically, motionless, as if unconscious what it was that he was doing. His cheeks flushed. The passing glow of color caused their condition of extraordinary and indeed extravagant attenuation to be more prominent than ever. The doctor laid him back upon the bed, feeling his pulse with one hand while he stood and regarded him in silence. Then, turning to the inspector, he said to him in an undertone, "If you want him to make a statement, he'll have to make it now. He's going fast. You won't be able to get much out of him. He's too far gone, and I shouldn't bustle him. But get what you can." The inspector came to the front, a notebook in his hand. "I understand from this gentleman," signifying Atherton, "that your name's Robert Holt. I'm an inspector of police, and I want you to tell me what has brought you into this condition. Has anyone been assaulting you?" Holt, opening his eyes, glanced up at the speaker mistily as if he could not see him clearly, still less understand what it was he was saying. Sidney, stooping over him, endeavored to explain. "The inspector wants to know how you got here. Has anyone been doing anything to you? Has anyone been hurting you?" The man's eyelids were partially closed, then they opened wider and wider. His mouth opened too. On his skeleton features there came a look of panic fear. He was evidently struggling to speak. At last, words came. "The beetle!" He stopped. Then, after an effort, spoke again. "The beetle! What's he mean?" asked the inspector. "I think I understand," Sidney answered. Then, turning again to the man in the bed, "Yes, I hear what you say, the beetle. Well, has the beetle done anything to you?" "It took me by the throat." "Is that the meaning of the marks upon your neck?" "The beetle killed me." The lids closed. The man relapsed into a state of lethargy. The inspector was puzzled and said so. "What's he mean about a beetle?" Atherton replied, "I think I understand what he means, and my friends do too. We'll explain afterwards. In the meantime, I think I'd better get as much out of him as I can while there's time." "Yes," said the doctor, his hand upon the patient's pulse, "while there's time. There isn't much, only seconds." Sidney endeavored to rouse the man from his stupor. "You've been with Miss Linden all the afternoon and evening, haven't you, Mr. Holt?" Atherton had reached a chord in the man's consciousness. His lips moved, in painful articulation. "Yes, all the afternoon and evening. God help me!" "I hope God will help you, my poor fellow. You've been in need of his help if ever a man was. Miss Linden is disguised in your old clothes, isn't she?" "Yes, in my old clothes. My God!" "And where is Miss Linden now?" The man had been speaking with his eyes closed. Now he opened them wide. There came into them the former staring horror. He became possessed by uncontrollable agitation, half raising himself in bed. Words came from his quivering lips as if they were only drawn from him by the force of his anguish. "The beetle's going to kill Miss Linden." A momentary paroxysm seemed to shake the very foundations of his being. His whole frame quivered. He fell back onto the bed ominously. The doctor examined him in silence, while we too were still. "This time he's gone for good. there'll be no conjuring him back again. I felt a sudden pressure on my arm and found that Lessingham was clutching me with probably unconscious violence. The muscles on his face were twitching. He trembled. I turned to the doctor. "Doctor, if there is any of that brandy left, will you let me have it for my friend?" Lessingham disposed of the remainder of the shilling's worth. I rather fancy it saved us from a scene. The inspector was speaking to the woman of the house. "Now, Mrs. Henderson, perhaps you'll tell us what all this means. Who is this man, and how did he come in here, and who came in with him? And what do you know about it altogether? If you've got anything to say, say it, only you'd better be careful, because it's my duty to warn you that anything you do say may be used against you." End of chapter 44. Mrs. Henderson put her hands upon her apron and smirked. "Well, Mr. Phillips, it do sound strange to hear you talking to me like that. Anybody'd think I'd done something as I didn't ought to do it done to hear you going on. As for what's happened, I'll tell you all I know with the greatest willingness on earth. And as for being careful, there ain't no call for you to tell me to be that. For that I always am, as by now you ought to know." "Yes, I do know. Is that all you have to say?" "Really, Mr. Phillips, what a man you are for catching people up, you really are. Of course that ain't all I got to say. Ain't I just a coming to it? Then come. If you presses me so you'll muddle me up, and then if I do happen to make a error, you'll say I'm a liar, when goodness knows there ain't no more truthful woman not in Limehouse." Words plainly trembled on the inspector's lips, which he refrained from uttering. Mrs. Henderson cast her eyes upwards as if she sought for inspiration from the filthy ceiling. "So far as I can swear, it might have been an hour ago, or it might have been an hour and a quarter, or it might have been an hour and 20 minutes. We're not particular as to the seconds. When I hears the knocking at my front door, and when I comes to open it, there was a Harrop party with a great bundle on his head bigger nor hisself, and two other parties along with him. This Harrop party says, in that queer foreign way them Harrop parties has of talking, 'A room for the night, a room.' Now, I don't much care for foreigners, and never did, especially them Harrops with their habits ain't my own. So I as much as inst the same. But this here Harrop party, he didn't seem to quite follow of my meaning, for all he done was to say as he said afore, 'A room for the night, a room.' And he shoves a couple of crowns in my hand. Now, it's always been a matter of mine that money is money, and one man's money is as good as another man's. So, not wishing to be disagreeable, which other people would have taken 'em if I hadn't, I shows 'em up here. I'd been downstairs, it might have been half an hour, when I hears a shindy a-coming from this room." "What sort of shindy?" "Yelling and shrieking? Oh, my gracious, it was enough to set your blood all curdled. For ear-piercingness, I never did hear nothing like it. We do have troublesome parties in here, like they do elsewhere, but I never did hear nothing like that before. I stood it for about a minute, but it kept on and kept on, and every moment I expected as the other parties as was in the house would be complaining. So up I comes and thumps at the door, and it seemed that thump I might for all the notice that was took of me." "Did the noise keep on?" "Keep on? I should think it did keep on. Lord, love you. Shriek after shriek, I expected to see the roof took off." "Were there any other noises? For instance, were there any sounds of struggling or of blows?" "There weren't no sounds except of the party hollering."
"One party only?"
"One party only. As I says afore, shriek after shriek. When you put your ear to the panel, there was a noise like some other party blubbering, but that weren't nothing. As for the hollering, you wouldn't have thought that nothing what you might call human could have kept up such a screeching. I thumps and thumps, and at last, when I did think that I should have had to have the door broke down, the Arab says to me from inside, 'Go away! I pay you for the room. Go away!' I did think that pretty good, I tell you that. So I says, 'Pay for the room or not pay for the room, you didn't pay to make that shindy.' And what's more, I says, 'If I hear it again,' I says, 'out you goes. And if you don't go quiet, I'll have somebody in as'll pretty quickly make you.'
Then was there silence?"
"So to speak, there was. Only there was a sound as if some party was a blubbering, and another sound as if a party was a panting for his breath."
"Then what happened?"
"Seeing that, so to speak, all was quiet, down I went. and in another quarter of an hour, or it might have been 20 minutes, I went to the front door to get a mouthful of hair. And Mrs. Barker, who lives over the road at number 24, she comes to me and says, "That there Arab party of yours didn't stop long." I looks at her. "I don't quite follow you," I says, which I didn't. "I saw him come in," she says, "and then a few minutes back I see him go again, with a great bundle on his head he couldn't hardly stagger under." "Oh," I says, "that's news to me. I didn't know he'd gone nor see him neither," which I didn't. So up I comes again, and sure enough the door was open, and it seems to me that the room was empty till I come upon this poor young man what was lying behind the bed. There was a growl from the doctor. "If you'd had any sense and sent for me at once, he might have been alive at this moment." How was I to know that, Dr. Glossop? I couldn't tell. My finding him there murdered was quite enough for me. So I runs downstairs, and I nips hold of Gustus Barley, what was leaning against the wall, and I says to him, "Gustus Barley, run to the station as fast as you can, and tell him that a man's been murdered, that Harrod's been and killed a bloke." And that's all I know about it, and I couldn't tell you no more, Mr. Phillips, not if you was to keep on asking me questions, not for hours and hours. "Then you think it was this man," with a motion towards the bed, "who was shrieking?" "To tell you the truth, Mr. Phillips, about that I don't hardly know what to think. If you'd had asked me, I should have said it was a woman. I ought to know a woman's holler when I hear it, if anyone does. I've heard enough of them in my time, goodness knows. And I should have said that only a woman could have hollered like that, and only her when she was raving mad. But there weren't no woman with him. There was only this man what's murdered and the other man. And as for the other man, I will say this, that he hadn't got 2 pennies worth of clothes to cover him. But Mr. Phillips, howsomever that may be, that's the last Harab I'll have under my roof, no matter what they pays. And you mark my words, I'll have no more." Mrs. Henderson, once more glancing upward, as if she imagined herself to have made some declaration of a religious nature, shook her head with much solemnity. End of chapter 45.